Hello, it's News Talk's Jess Kelly here. Before we get to this podcast, I want to talk to the business owners out there who know the value of having the right partner behind them. When it comes to empowering your business, Electric Ireland is the trusted energy brand that Irish companies rely on. As Ireland's leading energy supplier, they offer fixed price plans, expert advice and future-focused solutions, including solar power installation to support your business on its journey to net zero. Electric Ireland, making your business brighter. Visit electricireland.ie/business to learn more. Now, enjoy your podcast.
Henry's Happy New Year. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome to Henry's Happy New Year. I'm Henry McKean, and a Happy New Year. I hope you had a lovely New Year's Eve. Perhaps you were out celebrating, or maybe you slept through midnight. Whatever you did, whatever you got up to, Happy New Year. We're here for the next 2 hours, and we're going to be reflecting on 2025, the year that's just gone, and we're looking forward into 2026. And we're going to actually start with moments of 2025 which stood out for me. So these aren't necessarily news stories or big events. They just kind of stood out as I reported up and down the country. And one of them was Croke Park, and it was the Oasis gigs in August. They were absolutely massive. Here is a lady. She couldn't get in to the gig. She wasn't happy.
So you're standing outside here enjoying the gig too.
Yeah.
What's the best thing about it?
I love them. I love them to bits. Couldn't get a ticket because, you know yourself, just couldn't get a ticket. I was on the app for I don't know how long. I love them. I'm a diehard fan of Oasis and I couldn't get a ticket. I'm joined here now tonight.
We live nearby and just what an opportunity to get to hear them. Didn't get tickets. Once in a lifetime.
It's brilliant out here. We can hear every word.
The vibes are immaculate.
The atmosphere is brilliant. All the locals out. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
We're coming tomorrow night as well.
We're coming tomorrow as well.
Yes.
Here outside, the gig is just finishing. What do you love about the gig?
I don't love anything about the gig because most of the people around here don't get tickets. We're all left here stranded, we're all left here listening. It's ridiculous.
Ladies there who couldn't get in to see Oasis, they didn't have tickets. They were standing outside in August, and you can hear the passion in their voice, but also the disappointment. Another moment. This is actually quite recent. This was in December. It was Hamlet. This is the Irish premiere with Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal. And it was the biggest Irish premiere of the year. A real Oscar buzz around it. And we got to have a chat with Chloe Zhao, the Oscar-winning director.
Hi, I'm Chloe Zhao.
Chloe, how are you feeling? How is it out there here in Dublin? You could say it's a bit windswept. It's a bit like Hamlet.
Yes. I love it here in Dublin. I love it in Ireland. So I feel good here. I feel very grounded.
You know, you talk about grounded and the fact that this movie is extremely grounded. And the fact bringing such grief to screen and doing it so well, how proud are you of the project and of your cast and crew?
Immensely proud, you know, because the grief that they channel through isn't something that they have a vision of how it's going to be like. They very much stay present when they're on set, moment to moment, and that take a lot of psychic and physical strength.
And the buzz, I mean, you know, everyone wants a buzz around a movie, but for you, you must be delighted with that buzz, with the excitement.
As a filmmaker, I never take for granted that people will come out and see my film. So anything that can help people to go into the theaters, to have this experience with each other together, is amazing.
That was Chloe Zhao there, the Oscar-winning director. And yeah, more than likely she could win another Oscar for this particular one. Keep an eye out for that. In October, we spoke with the rioters and the protesters outside City West, as the Gardaí started to clear the protesters and try and regain control of the streets. I was driving back from Cork and I kind of sort of stumbled into the riot, and it was pretty ugly. They were really kind of ugly scenes. And I bumped into this lady who had fallen.
I live here in the area. I left because I knew it was a protest. I said, I'll go down and do a bit of shopping. Coming down, I was starting. So we walked down to City West. I had a dog and all with me, right?
And why did you come down to the protest?
I didn't. I went shopping in City West while it was going on to get out of the area. And it was, I was told it was done and was coming back up. And they knew me. They know I live here. They know I live in the village. And I'm living here 16 years.
So, yeah, that was the City West riots there. Just in the autumn, they were pretty ugly scenes there in October. Another moment earlier in the year was the conclave. So there I was in Rome, in the Vatican. I waited around for hours and hours looking at a chimney. I've never stared at a chimney for that long. I looked at the chimney on and off for 24 hours, literally staring at a chimney. And then one time I got a bit bored, a bit like that Kit Kat advert with the panda, if you remember it. And I went for a cappuccino, but I made sure I could still see the chimney. And it went black, black, black smoke. So I ran out. Did a live link up with the Pat Kenny show. And then, you know, eventually, waiting around, it finally turned white. That meant that they had voted for a new pope. It was happening. We didn't know who it was at the stage. We still didn't know. We had to wait and wait, but we knew it was white smoke. It was going to be Pope Leo. So here we are in St. Peter's Square, the moment it happened at last May.
We have smoke. We have smoke, and it's white smoke. We have white smoke here at St. Peter's Basilica. We've been waiting. It's white smoke. It's happened. We have a new pope here at the Vatican, and the crowd have exploded. The bells are ringing here at the Vatican. It's happened, it's white smoke. And there is real scenes of joy.
So some moments there from 2025 that stood out for me. Let us know what stood out for you. Remember, I am on social media. I'm just at Henry McKean. I'm on X and I'm also on Instagram. So check that out. Now we're going to talk about the Special Olympics Ireland Games that are based in Dublin this year, and they're taking place from the 18th to the 21st of June. And we can't wait. And in studio, they've come in especially on New Year's Day to join us. We have Dara Kinnan, a badminton player, and also Ashwin, a basketball player. Thank you so much for coming into studio.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much for inviting us.
So for you, I mean, tell us a little bit about your journey to get here, to get to the Ireland Games happening in June. Dara, we'll start with you. Tell us about yourself and your journey being a badminton player.
Well, I suppose it's really tough, but I love competing. I love seeing my friends. I make new friends all the time. I suppose that when I do have to work hard and I do have to train every week and, you know, put in the effort, and I'm glad that it paid out this year.
So you've got two youngest siblings and mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about them. And there's a connection there with Special Olympics and the family. Tell us a little bit about that, a little bit about what other members of the family have got up to, and yourself as well.
So when I was 11 years old, I first joined Season Shuttles Badminton Club. And then soon later on, my sister and brother joined in. And we all competed for a competition. I think it was for the regional games. And we qualified, well, the area games. And I think it was the region, sorry.
Oh, it's okay.
But we competed to go to the Ireland Games, and we all got through, and we all got to represent the badminton in the Ireland Games in 2018, which my brother came home with two gold. My sister came home with a gold and a fourth place.
Unbelievable.
And I got two bronzes.
Congratulations. And you, I understand, you love animals and you also love your parrot. Tell us about your parrot.
Mango, he's like my child, if you can explain, if I can explain. For example, he's very loud. He likes to talk. He never be's quiet. He's like me. He won't stop talking. But he's also very hard to look after, but it makes it more rewarding because he, you know, he's like a child. When I say we go to bed for the last time, last night, he wouldn't go asleep because he was so, like, he wanted his family around him, and I had to stay up till about 11 o'clock at night with him.
Wow, and you've also got a dog called Max.
Yeah.
Tell us also, you're self-taught when it comes to playing instruments. Mm-hmm. What have you learned?
Irish flute, tin whistle.
Oh, wow.
Trying to learn violin.
So you're kept very, very busy, and you have a powerboat license.
Yes.
So that's like a speedboat, is it?
Yeah, so it's like rigid inflatable.
Oh, brilliant.
Boat, yeah.
So you are really a go-getter. And for you, representing Ireland, how does that feel, you know, in June? And for the family and for the community and for everyone in your club, you now play at Flying Trojans in Terranium.
Yeah, everyone's excited, and I'm happy to represent their club for the Ireland Games. I'm really excited to experience it.
Like, I was over at the World Summer Games in 2019, and obviously, you know, being out in the Arab world, it happened in the spring around St. Patrick's weekend, and it was unbelievable. For you, I mean, these journeys and travelling to faraway places, is it something you always dreamt of?
Yes. Yeah, I've always wanted to go to the World Games as an athlete. It is my dream.
Ashwin, we're going to have a chat with you now. We're going to talk about basketball, and we're also going to talk about your journey and all the different sports you played. In front of us, for the listeners at home, you've got lots and lots of medals. I don't know if you can hear them there. Oh, so I call them medals. My son calls them medals. They are medals, I should say. What do you have? Describe some of them for me.
So the first medal I have is a Special Olympics Ireland COVID medal. It's basically because in COVID time, we were not able to do any activities like that at the leadership, so any workshops. So we had to do them online, which was not easy because...
It was a difficult time, COVID, yeah. Wasn't it? It was very hard. So you were learning, you were online, and, you know, the fact that athletes everywhere, the commitment, it was so tough on athletes because they wanted to be out playing sport, representing their country. And this June... for the Ireland Games, you'll all be representing your county, your area, your region. It really is quite exciting. Also, what is it you love about basketball?
I love basketball because I love to play the sport, and I also like to play with my teammates, and I've been with the Colesta Basketball Club since 2010, so it's 15 years ago.
15 years you've been at it? Wow.
And I just love all the coaches, and I love the sport I play. I like to play for the team, and I also like playing matches.
And you love playing matches. You're a Special Olympics Ireland ambassador, and you've been one of them for many years. You represent the Special Olympics and the movement and all the other athletes. How do you find that? What's it like being an ambassador?
It's actually very nice. Sometimes it can be a bit busy and a bit chaotic because sometimes you would think that you have no events to do, and then all of a sudden an event will come out of nowhere.
So you're quiet, and then you're suddenly busy, a bit like us in News Talk. It's quiet. Oh my goodness me. I need to go to this event, and do this, and shake lots of hands. And do you like that? Do you like meeting people and representing the Special Olympics?
Absolutely.
It's one of your favourite things. And how do you relax, you know, when you're not playing basketball or involved in sport?
So, like, sometimes at home, I would listen to music. I would talk to my parents I also sometimes go for a walk, and sometimes I will go to the gym and swimming.
Of course, swimming is you're training, cool. aren't you? You're yeah. training, and you love that.
Yeah.
And for you, you know, it's 2026, the Ireland Games are at home. How exciting is that? And are you looking forward to it?
I am so looking forward to it, and it's really exciting because next year will be 20 years since I live in Ireland, because when I was born in 2003, I was not originally born in Ireland. I was originally born in India, so was my mum and dad. So next year, it will be special because not only is 20 years we live in Ireland, but it's my first time competing in a team sport, in basketball.
I just want to thank the two of you for coming in to News Talk on New Year's Day to talk about the Special Olympics Ireland Games in Dublin in June. So it's the 18th to the 21st. Thank you so much, Dara, for coming in. And also, Ashwin, thank you. Thank you so much for joining us, and Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Henry's Happy New Year. This is News Talk.
And you're very welcome back to Henry's Happy New Year, and a Happy New Year wherever you are listening, in Ireland or abroad. And I hope you had a great New Year's Eve. I'm now in front of Barry Dempsey, a mental health advocate. Barry, Happy New Year.
Henry, many happy returns to you.
Well, look, thank you so much for coming in on New Year's Day. For you, what does New Year bring? What does New Year stand for? And we're here, I suppose, talking about men everywhere, especially men, mm-hmm. and the pressure that a new year can bring.
That's exactly it. You said it. New Year brings so much opportunity. There's so much newness, so many adventures that you can take. And it also brings, I suppose, in the fine print or the small print, there's a little bit of pressure that comes with it, that you have to get it right, that it's an unwritten script, and you have to be able to make the best of it and put your best foot forward. And as we know, January is about 300 years long, so it just carries that sense of what are you going to do with your time, social expectation, priorities. And I suppose for everybody, we always step into January going, right, what are we going to do? How are we going to make this count? But then for men especially, because that's kind of a passion area of mine, men would find it probably pretty hard to be able to kind of find themselves in that space where they can be grounded and centered, plan ahead, but plan in bite-sized pieces. I think they try to take everything on all at once.
And Barry, I know you mentioned January for many out there can be a miserable, dark month. Mm-hmm. I love January. I think I'm the only person who loves it. I love the way you can get a seat in the pub. I love the way that Christmas is over. Okay. I love the freezing cold. And just for me, I feel the pressure is off. I feel the pressure is before Christmas. But for young men or men of any age, you know, it is a major, you know, issue for so many, because perhaps they feel their life isn't where they hope it to be in 2026, and they might have debts left over from Christmas. They might be really quite miserable. How can those men pick themselves up?
Okay, well, there's a few ways that you can do that. I mean, so that statistically you have Blue Monday, which comes at the third week of January. So it's far enough into the new year where New Year's resolutions as such have kind of maybe gone pear-shaped. And there's that sort of sense of self or self-esteem is kind of waning. All the memories of the gloss of Christmas have worn off. The weather is bleaker, it's colder.
It's darker.
Things are darker. Now, some people do prefer that. I'll give you your dues, fair enough. But for the majority, it just means it's just a bit of a lonely kind of time. And that loneliness then can really get in on people. So what we would always kind of say to lads and men in particular is to, you know, to try to open up, try to communicate, try to connect is essential. And it's a time when maybe family has kind of drifted away and you're left with your own thoughts as well. There's loads of groups out there. There's loads of social groups. There's loads of men who look to empower men and help men and reduce the stigma, because I think historically men just find it really hard to reach out until maybe something has got to a crisis level, and then they think it's worth reaching out.
So you're saying, Barry, men leave it to the last minute. They could be at a low ebb. Mm-hmm. They could be broke. They could really be feeling it, and they only reach out for help perhaps sometimes when it's very late in the day.
Yeah, I think men tend to stay away from the kind of clinical or the medicalized model. So we don't go to the GP until we have something worth complaining about, which is usually manifests physically as well. And that goes for mentally as well. Sometimes that goes under the radar. It's harder to see. It's harder to diagnose. So it's usually kind of when things get to a state where somebody thinks, okay, now it's worth going to see somebody because their thoughts have got dark or they just feel completely alone or disenfranchised. And that's when it could be even a little bit too late to get some sort of help. So it's always easier to kind of, prevention is better than cure, essentially.
And Barry, you've been working in this area of social care and mental health for over 25 years. What have you learnt and what advice would you give to people out there who are struggling today?
Just to anybody. I mean, I suppose over the years I've worked with like a lot of diverse groups, and that's been in terms of like psychiatry and mental health and supporting ex-prisoners and disability. I've kind of worked everywhere with a lot of people, and essentially the same kind of current trend is just like, take the time to have a conversation, to listen to people, to treat people like you'd like to be treated, and just always kind of have an open ear and an open heart as well, because the world is full of pressure. We have constant expectation and pressures on us, but...
And it's coming from everywhere. I mean, it's coming from family,
angle.
Friends. It's coming from social media.
Every angle.
It's coming from here on the radio. This perfect life, especially on Instagram. Everything is perfect.
And that's it.
That's not reality.
Yeah, and that's it. And it's young people as well are kind of like... You know, looking at this lifestyle, and everybody, I think on Instagram and TikTok, usually people tend to put their best foot forward and it's not really their best self, but it's this kind of mirror image of who they are. And it's not exactly representative of life as you would see it. So to be kind of authentic and genuine and look out for each other, and kindness breeds kindness as well. So it's just to have that chance to be able to check in with each other.
And we do have a list of various support groups that can help. That we've got phone numbers, which I can give out. Or would you think I should give them out? Or maybe, Barry, do you want to list them off there?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, it's a whole, it's a non-exhaustive list. But what we have is we've got like texting, free text spun out to 50808. The Samaritans are absolutely amazing and unsung heroes at what they do. And that's free phone on 116123. For more serious kind of emergency crisis problems, there's Pieta House, and you can call 1-800-247-247. Turn to Me is a free counselling online service, and that's absolutely amazing as well. And they would have free counselling for young people aged 12 to 17 and also over 18. And then for groups like more pro-social groups, there's groups like blueballs.ie. And I'd be a member of Blue Balls. We're a kind of a swim group, a men's meetup group, and you can find all the information online and the pages are out there too, or on Instagram at Blue Balls Ireland. And then there's also the Dublin Boys Club, Selbridge Boys Club, Men Rising Together. And these are all for connection, outdoor hikes, meetups, events, men's circles, just a chance to come together. Drop the mask, no expectation. Everybody can just come together. Ego is left at the door and you can just get like every need met nearly. It's hugs, warm embraces, and chances are somebody is there and they've walked in your shoes as well.
And you mentioned drop the mask, and we need to do that. All of us do. You have a quote for us, don't you? You've given me a quote. There is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. What does that mean?
I think everybody has that kind of sense of something that they want to talk about, something that they want to own. And in a busy, disconnected world, there's not always someone there who kind of is actively listening to it. But if the parameters are right and the conversation is okay and you're between two friends or even with a perfect stranger and you just have the climate is okay, you're able to just unburden yourself and just maybe take a little bit of a load off what you're carrying as well, just by having yourself heard. Sometimes that's to be seen, sometimes that's to be heard, sometimes that's just checking in and saying, how are you doing? That's all it can be. It can be very basics of human kind of contact and human nature. And it's so empowering and it can go so far as well. But keeping all that kind of stuff to yourself, not having an outlet, that's where the damage is done. And that's where people can start to reach for substances, reach for alcohol, reach for crutches, gambling, maladaptive coping mechanisms, and that's where the kind of problems can actually start. So it's just a way of staying in check with yourself and showing up for yourself.
And for me, Barry, you know, if I'm feeling a little bit down, for me, it's just picking up the phone, ringing a family member, ringing a friend. That always cheers me up. That's what I do.
Excellent.
How do you cheer yourself up when you're down?
Okay, so for me it is, and I probably learned the hard way, it was that sort of stigma thing for me was, you know, opening up is for the weak, or stiff upper lip, or head down, keep peddling. You know, that kind of negative trope that you hear for men, and it's boys don't cry and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, for me, it's all reaching out. Like I've a very healthy circle. I've very strong people in my life. I'm very lucky to have a very strong mother. I have a very strong sister, my wife as well. But also outside of that, then I've got my pastimes and my hobbies and my cold water plunge, which is my daily church. And I do that every morning.
Tell me about it. I mean, today's New Year's Day and people across the nation are cold water plunging.
Well, that's the thing. Tell us. Absolutely. So for me, cold water is just essentially, it's my non-negotiable. It's my go-to. It just keeps me grounded, keeps me in the moment. If I'm in the sea or if I'm in my cold plunge out the back, it's everything fades away. Nothing matters. And I'm right in that moment. And I can only think about the cold and being there. And for me, then it has long lasting effects throughout the day. And I'll then kind of stack that habit on top of maybe some breath work in the morning, like about 10 minutes. And that's what I'll do. And those are my kind of things. They're my go-to. If I don't do them, my day won't go the way I want it to go. And that's just something I want to always do going forward. And when my kids are in the kitchen having their breakfast, looking out at me getting into this thing, I just think that maybe they're like, okay, he's a little off the boil today, but they know it's something that's good for me. And I want them to know to lean in to what works for them as well. And to know that, you know, sometimes you have to reach out and you have to do something different as well to make yourself feel kind of good. So today, a lot of people are going for sea swims. A lot of people are going for forest walks. It's really whatever it is that kind of like lights that little fire in you. If that's like you said, Henry, like chatting to your family, meeting your family, phone call, online chat, whatever it might be. There's something there for all of us. And for me, it took a while to tap into what it was that worked for me. But now I found it and I wouldn't be able to do anything differently now. So it's all about that for me.
Well, Barry Dempsey, mental health advocate, Happy New Year. Thank you so much for joining us on Henry's Happy New Year. Back after these.
Henry's Happy New Year. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome back to Henry's Happy New Year. Now, do you remember when Pele visited Ballymun? Because I actually don't recall it at all. I don't recall Pele coming to Dublin, let alone visiting Ballymun, but he did back in 2009. I got to visit Trinity Comprehensive, the school there in Ballymun, the secondary school, and I met the PE teacher who brings us back to 2009.
Hiya doing, Paddy O'Reilly is my name, Trinity Comprehensive PE teacher, Ballymun.
Happy New Year, and we're here in Trinity Comprehensive in Ballymun. We're in the classroom. We're going back to November 2009. You had a very special visitor to the school.
Yes, we had indeed. There's a man called Don Mullen who was in touch with the FAI, and they're raising money for children's hospitals in Brazil, and who happened to be in the country at the same time as we were opening part of the school, only Pele. And through the kind offices of a man in FAI called Derek O'Neill, Pele ended up landing in a helicopter on the AstroTurf in our school. Amazing.
So perhaps the most famous player in the world, the best player in the world, stopped off, landed a helicopter at your school. What was that like? And how did the students react?
It was mad because, you know, when things like that, you almost had to do a waiting list for who was being allowed in to see him. And all the politics, in a good way, I like the word politics, came into play. And you were sneaking people in as camera people, you were sneaking in people as meet and greet people, just so to get a feel and a look at the great man. So it was a wonderful day because he crossed a lot of boundaries. I think when he was playing soccer, a little bit like Messi, he had a lovely personality as well, and it was all about the beautiful game. So it was an amazing day for the school and for the community when he came.
And Ballymun loves sport. You're a PE teacher. You love soccer, don't you?
Yes. And I mean, Ballymun United would probably be the strongest junior soccer team in the country at the time. They're now trying to get into the League of Ireland. Ballymun Kickhams have the most all-stars of any Dublin club. in Dublin or any All Stars. So you have a really strong tradition across all the sports in Ballymun. And at the time, this sort of just put a little bit of a cap on those achievements.
What was Pelé like? Obviously, a World Cup winner, a global superstar. Meeting him in the flesh, what was he like? And describe the moment he met you, I should say.
Yeah, well, he can still talk about it. Sorry, sure, he's dead. No, I'm only joking. But it was lovely because he was, if you can judge someone in that short of time, he came across as very, very humble. He struck you as being conscious of his amazing gift with people. And, he seemed to be very, very dignified. And it was just wonderful.
And, you know, as soccer goes, I've only been to one World Cup. It was 2010, and it was South Africa. It was Cape Town, and Nelson Mandela was no longer present at that time, but he was still alive. And would it be fair to say that Pelé had that same kind of elder statesman in the football world? Could you compare him to Nelson Mandela?
Yeah, I think so. And funny enough, Henry, I've only been at one World Cup as well, and that was the one in Brazil, because I have a brother, a priest, and he was a priest in Brazil at the time. So we went out to Brazil, and in the back of my mind, it was partly the whole Pelé connection, because I'm sure he has done wonders for the economy in Brazil, given his personality alone and his feats on the soccer pitch. So no, he is at that level, yeah, no question.
How did the students react meeting Pelé? Because at the end of the day, you could say it was Pelé giving back to another community thousands of miles away from Brazil.
We're all needy creatures. So up to recently, my Facebook picture was a picture of myself and Pelé. So constantly, even present day pupils would ask you, was he really here? Was he really here? And there's a pretty famous picture. I think it's on the FAI website. I'm not sure, of Henry wearing the FAI jacket after getting out of a helicopter, landing on our AstroTurf beside the building that he was open. So students to this day still talk about it in disbelief, and they're people that have not grown up with Pelé, you know.
And I'll be honest, I don't remember the story in 2009. Where was I in 2009 in November? Oh, I think I was on some weekend away in Berlin or something. I totally missed it. So it's not an urban myth. It actually happened. And for you and for the school, you still talk about it, still comes up.
Yeah, it does. And we have a picture in the front foyer of Pelé. And it's little stories like this that resonate. I'll give you another example. 3 or 4 weeks ago, we went over to St Mirren, and Killian Phillips, the Irish international from Kilbarry, kindly met all the Ballymun pupils in a hotel in Glasgow. And then St Mirren beat Celtic in the Scottish Premier Cup final. And all our lads are watching because they've met Killian Phillips, and he played the full 90, as he does for every time in St Mirren. And he kindly liked some of our Instagram posts, despite the fact him being in the throes of celebration with St Mirren. And you have the same resonance, you know, thanks to the FAI at the time, Don Mullen, the humanitarian fundraiser for Brazilian hospitals, the good offices of all the different sports organisations in Ballymun at the time. Events like that go on and keep having a positive effect.
And, you know, it gives a lift. And I want to ask you about the playoffs. It's giving the whole country a lift. It's January 1st, it's 2026. We've got to wait until March 26th for that first playoff game. How do you feel about it all?
Yeah, I'd be optimistic. Once the players don't go in riding on the crest of the wonderful optimism that the Irish soccer supporter has, I think they stand a great chance, because I think we're a little bit harsher on our soccer team than we are on most teams, and I'm not sure why. I think some teams get a free pass, but the soccer team never do. That's for another programme. But a lot of the Irish soccer team, they're actually captains at their clubs, like Josh Cullen, Nathan Collins, Seamus Coleman in the past. A lot of them are leaders, and that comes out. So I'd be cautiously optimistic.
Paddy O'Reilly, PE teacher here in Trinity Comprehensive in Ballymun. Happy New Year, and thank you for bringing us back to when Pelé visited your school.
Thank you, Henry. Fair play. Thank you.
Henry's Happy New Year. This is News Talk.
And you're very welcome back to Henry's Happy New Year. Happy New Year. And I'm actually joined by Richie McCormack from the Bauer Media Digital Team. Richie, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Henry. Happy New Year to the listeners out there too.
Well, look, thank you so much for coming in. I want to talk to you about soccer. I want to talk to you about the Irish Republic of Ireland team and the playoffs and also the World Cup in the Americas, in Canada, the USA, Mexico. I probably have them in the wrong order.
Well, descending north to south, you're spot on.
I want to ask you a little bit about nostalgia as well and about the excitement we had in 2025 to that Troy Parrott hat-trick and how it just exploded across the country. Talk me through that, and why is it that soccer seems to bring everyone together perhaps than any other sport?
The last part of that is actually a really tricky one to answer. How it has managed to bring people together, especially during a time when the Republic of Ireland's international men's team isn't associated with success. I would have grown up with qualifying for World Cups as being the norm. So like three out of four between 99 and 2002, the Republic of Ireland were present at European Championships. A slightly different story, but they were there in 88. They came close to getting there in 92 and 96. But most recently, we've seen obviously the Euros that Ireland have qualified. So the notion that the Republic of Ireland team is a successful entity and is one that bandwagoners are automatically attached to just doesn't really hold, because, you know, we're not really latching on to success. But when you see those scenes that were doing the rounds on TG Carr, it was in particular, they were covering, I think it was a GAA game down the 6 Mile Bridge at the time when Parrott's third goal went in.
Yes.
Like, they're watching the game unfold in front of them. That's a completely different sport, but they're seeing notifications that Parrott has scored and Ireland have banked themselves a playoff. And there's jubilation around the sidelines for a game that they haven't even seen.
Just like from a notification.
That's the, I think that's the cut through the football has. And you even see it, like, anecdotally, listening to podcasts before Christmas when they were talking about the scandal about World Cup ticket prices. They were wondering, like, this isn't a very sexy story when you're talking about, you know, the how things are priced and whether or not there's the demand for
three and a half grand for the final.
All that kind of stuff. But, you know, it turns out that these articles do end up doing quite well just because there's a cut through in terms of World Cup. There is something about a World Cup that has managed to grab not just this nation, like you can go back through dozens and dozens of nations that have qualified down through the years. It grabs a populace like very few other social, political, or any such events can do, all as one. And it gathers everybody together and everybody is on the same level. There is no sides then involved. And I think that's what's probably a welcome respite for people, is that there is this giant sense of belonging and there is no one side or the other within the confines of your own country. It is one people together. And that's something that international sports can do better than most. And it's something that international football among sport does better than everybody.
Yeah, football like that, it does. It really does bring everyone together. And like that, I moved to Ireland, as you know, Richie, in 1990, during Italian 90. And I've been bandwagoning ever since. And I admit that I am on that bandwagon.
Yeah,
I remember being on that famous train across Slovakia that the certain person gave us free beer on board. Again,
he who shall not be named. Yeah, Voldemort.
And like that, you know, the memories, and even listening to Off the Ball, Brian O'Driscoll was on talking about rugby, and he ended up talking about soccer, and he admitted that football, it's so much bigger than rugby. It's so big.
Everybody plays it. Like, everybody plays it, and you can play it in any scenario, in any specific case. Like, with GAA and with hurling in particular, with the best will in the world, it is, you know, a niche sport played by, you know, people in very specific locales. You can get a ball and knock it against the wall in your back garden. You can knock it against the wall in an alleyway. You can play it on your road, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can do that to a point with Gaelic football, albeit a smaller version of it. You can do it with rugby, albeit probably in a touch rugby kind of sense, but it'll never have the cut through of football. Football is just the sport that people can pick up no matter what they have at their disposal and try and emulate what they see on TV or in the stands of a stadium.
And like that, with that game in the Aviva against Portugal, Rich, I was offered a ticket and I turned it down. I know.
To be fair, right?
Yeah.
Nobody saw this coming.
Yes.
Like, this is like, those last two games were like studying for the most impossible subjects you could have in your leaving cert and thinking, right, I'm going to come out with, at best, D's.
And I'm going to do cramming.
Both of these. Mm. But I'm going to cram for them. Anything that comes from them is a bonus. We got two bonuses at the end of the year. We lost to Armenia away from home. Nobody saw us getting a playoff in for a World Cup finals place with a rather favourable group, it would turn out, towards the end of this World Cup qualifying campaign. People were right to be sceptical going into the Portugal game. People still had a right to be sceptical going into the Hungary game. Things like that Troy Parrott hat-trick, things like scoring in the 6th minute of added time, they typically don't happen to Republic of Ireland squads. They haven't happened, certainly, in any lifetime that I can remember. The qualification processes that I remember were built on steady foundations, not conceding at home, and, you know, making the best of your away games. We never really, like, I think back to the Macedonia last minute concession of a goal. I think to losing on away goals. I think to the game in Belgium that was ultimately decided by a throw in, over which there's slight contested stuff in 97. All these things we kind of fall foul of and always have fallen foul of. The dodgy referees that went along with the 86 World Cup qualifying campaign. All of these.
The Henri handball.
The Henri handball, exactly. We always come, or typically have always come, a cropper this side of things. We never get the last minute winner. We never get the injury.
It was magic, wasn't it?
There was a specific kind of magic that went along with that goal. That dropped grown men to their knees, had people crying in front of it. I shed a tear just because of the novelty of it. It does not happen, the Republic of Ireland football team. It just doesn't. And it did.
We
have a playoff.
Yes.
And we're like potentially 180 minutes away from a World Cup finals. This is just unfathomable stuff. And it's a very now tangible prospect, because winning becomes a habit. People, you know, coaches will tell you this thing, and it can be a little bit airy-fairy kind of coaching talk, but there is a reality to it, that winning does become a habit. You get that sense that you're not going to be beaten today. And if you have your best 11 and everybody is pulling together, then you're going to get a result out of this thing. So there's every reason to believe that Ireland can go to Prague in March and get a result and set up that playoff final, be it at home to North Macedonia or away to Denmark. Such will be the nature of the draw. And then you look at the actual group of the World Cup finals: South Korea, South Africa, and Mexico. Two games in Mexico, one near Guadalajara, the middle game in Atlanta, and then the clincher against Mexico at the Azteca Stadium, where Pelé, you know, helped Brazil win 4-1 against an incredible Italy side in 1970, where Diego Maradona scored the best goal, the different class goal that Jimmy McGee described it as, against England in the quarterfinals in 86, and then set up Jorge Burruchaga for the winner. These are stadiums that are dripping in iconic moments. Mm. Republic of Ireland could well get to be part of that in June.
Wow. And you're allowing the listeners at home on New Year's Day to dream. Are we dreaming too much, or is it okay to dream?
On New Year's Day, Henry, you can never dream too much. Today is the one day where people should allow themselves that notion that everything for these next 364 days that are to come after this one will work out okay, or at least until the summer, when we've gotten through to a World Cup finals, when three games could become four and could become five. And then who knows what would happen. The only caveat I will say is Ireland typically don't perform well in heat. You only have to think back to Orlando in 1994, and it will be an oppressively hot World Cup, whether or not you're playing in the United States or Mexico. Canada might be a slightly different story, although they'll probably tell us as well that they'll be warm. But for today, on New Year's Day, think through to March. Think positive thoughts about getting through two playoff games and then into what is, let's be honest, a slightly favourable group in the World Cup finals themselves, albeit one of the co-hosts. But South Africa and South Korea and Mexico, given the form that the Republic of Ireland showed in those last two games of 2025, shows that nothing should be considered out of the question for this World Cup qualifying campaign.
So anything is possible. Richie McCormack from the Bauer Digital Group, thanks for joining us here on New Year's Day. And let's hope that 2026, the whole of the Republic of Ireland can dream.
Henry's Happy New Year. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome back to Henry's Happy New Year. Now we're going to talk about the Irish Museum of Time. I drove down to Waterford and I actually felt like I was in a time machine. Time stopped as I walked in to this beautiful, beautiful museum. Take a listen.
So my name is Cliona Purcell and I'm head curator here at Waterford Treasures, which includes the Irish Museum of Time.
And we're surrounded by clocks from all over the world and we're looking at the history of time. Time is on our side. It's New Year's Day and this is Henry's Happy New Year. Tell me about this amazing museum.
Well, I'll tell you what, there's no better place to ring in the new year than here. You'll hear a lot of bells going as we go around. But here in the museum, we're based in this incredible 1884 Methodist church, which is a beautiful atmospheric space for some of the most important timepieces in Irish history. So we're all about clocks here, and we have some of the oldest Irish clocks and some of the most important Irish clocks sort of surrounding us here.
This really is impressive for the listeners at home. I've never seen anything quite like it. For example, we're surrounded by grandfather clocks.
You know, the idea goes right back now a very long time, but it goes back here for ourselves to 2017, when one of our two incredible benefactors, Coleman Curran, first approached us here with this incredible collection of clocks that he had collected over his entire lifetime. And it sort of started off this really exciting period for us of, like, you know, where do we put it and what stories do we tell as part of it? And over the course of that development, our second benefactor, David Bowles, came on board with even more clocks. So all in all, you know, there's over a century worth of clock collecting in this building, and there's some really amazing pieces. I mean, you referenced our grandfather clocks, for instance. We call them long case clocks here.
That's the proper term.
That's the proper term.
So, long case.
Long
clocks.
Case.
Why are they called grandfather clocks?
So that actually goes to a nursery rhyme called My Grandfather's Clock, which would have been really popular in the late Victorian period. And it just really stuck and it just kind of got that name. But there's sort of really funny terminology associated with clocks that you get to know as you go around the museum. For instance, if you ever see a clock face separated from its clock, that's known as an orphan dial.
An orphan dial.
An orphan dial.
What a beautiful but also sad name.
It's terrible. And what's quite funny is if you see a case with no face, that's actually a divorced clock. So we're not sure why it splits, but it does. So it's a sort of a funny detail.
And yourself, how did you end up being the curator here for this group of museums?
I've actually been placed here now for, gosh, going on 2 years. So my predecessor, Eamon McEnany, would have retired in 2023, and I would have taken over in May of 2024. So it's a lot of responsibility, but a really, really exciting group of museums.
And it's 2026. Tell me a little bit about what we need to look out for in this amazing, amazing space full of time. And time is on our side.
Yeah, absolutely. You'll see some really interesting pieces. For instance, you'll see a number of turret clocks. A turret clock separated out from its tower doesn't really look like much. It looks a bit confusing to the eye, but what they are the earliest accurate clocks, and they usually don't have faces because they were about 10 feet up. So we're stood next to two turret clocks here at the moment, and Ireland's first public clock would have gone in the 15th century, which would have been one of these sort of examples. But I suppose for most visitors, the really, really important piece is actually our Clement clock, which you can see right in the centre of the museum here, pride of place, if you will. And the Clement clock, at its simplest, is the first clock ever to go tick-tock. It's a very it's a very noisy museum, but all of the noise is beautiful, you know, it's very atmospheric. So a lot of clockmakers would have also made extra objects, so a number of automaton music boxes. So we'll play a few of those for you later on.
Fantastic. And tell us about the first ever timepiece or clock.
The earliest timepieces known to man are sundials, actually, and they would have been made in Babylon for the first time. The earliest extant sundial on Earth is 4,500 years old, and it's in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt. Here in Ireland, there is an 800-year-old sundial down in County Kerry. So obviously, clockmaking is not something that Ireland was solely doing. It was happening all over the world, and different countries are responsible for different incredible inventions that really changed the face of time, if you will. But up here, we're currently in the Swiss section, and which country is more associated with clockmaking today than Switzerland, you know?
And why are the Swiss so good at watches?
Do you know, it goes back a very long time to kind of the 17th century when clockmaking really exploded in Switzerland. Prior to that, you'd get countries like France and Germany that were really associated with it, but the political climate in Switzerland in the 17th century really allowed a lot of this clockmaking to explode in popularity. But they also branched out. So next to us here at the moment, for instance, is a Swiss music box, and they're producing a lot of these kind of things as well. And this one is is really very, very special because not only is it a music box, it's also an automaton. So you can imagine the excitement of bringing something like this into the house because it's mechanical and it moves. So you can see all of these little birds and everything and they flap their wings and they sort of move around. So it really was sort of just an incredible invention during this period. This one is 1880.
Wow.
And you have to remember, these clocks and these machines, they were the supercomputers of their day, you know?
They were.
Absolutely. And it's like a lot of sort of gentlemen, for instance, would have more than one clock in their study to show off, you know, this idea that they were really very well connected in the sciences because they had these incredible machines there. And when you keep in mind, this is before the advent of electric light. These people were doing this incredibly intricate work by candlelight or by daylight a lot of the time. So it's a really, really sort of very special skill to have had. And there were no factories. They were making everything by hand.
And I've just noticed some Swatch watches behind me. I love a Swatch watch. Obviously, they are Swiss. Tell us why you have them here.
Well, I suppose they're so iconic, for one thing. My first watch was a Swatch watch when I was 10. So it's you couldn't really have a Museum of Time without putting a Swatch watch in there. And of course, it speaks to this legacy of clockmaking that's still very active in Switzerland today. You know, a lot of these really sort of incredibly fashionable horology companies that would be, you know, just such a step above sort of mass-produced clocks are still very active in Switzerland today.
And I've noticed that one's dating back to, I think, 1996. So it's only 30 years old.
I was one when that was made, so.
We're sticking with Switzerland and a town that never was. Here we are, January 1st, 2026. What do we have here?
So this is one of the real reasons that we have such pride of place here with the Swiss collection. And it's a town called New Geneva. So in 1783, really big year for Ireland. We've just achieved legislative independence under Henry Grattan's parliament. And Ireland is kind of looking to put itself on the map. And one of these ideas that it hits upon is bringing in lots of these incredibly accomplished Swiss clockmakers.
Oh, there's another clock going off.
It'll keep happening. So these Swiss clockmakers, they sort of make this plan to bring them in. They get, you know, some of these incredible architects to design this town here in County Waterford. £20,000 is given to set it up, and it gets so far, and then it just all falls through.
Why did it fall through?
There's a number of reasons for it. There was a sort of, I suppose these Swiss clockmakers are also fleeing a very tense political situation in Geneva. They're very keen to sort of, you know, run themselves, basically, but Ireland has also just achieved this independence, and they're very keen to run everything. So unfortunately, while it was a wonderful idea, and we'd love to have seen it happen, it just wasn't to be. We're in the international section up here on the top floor. We've got lots of different countries represented. One of my favourites is Japan. And Japan is particularly interesting in terms of their clockmaking. You'll notice the clocks are very different looking here in this section. And that's because one thing that we don't always keep in mind is that time didn't always look the same right across the world. For a period of time in Japan, a day was 12 hours long, and that was 6 hours of daylight and 6 hours of nighttime.
Wow, so there was 2 days in one day.
Yeah, it's a kind of an unusual thing. And obviously daylight and nighttime are not the same length. So how did that work? And actually Japan, an hour was a kind of a floating concept. An hour changed right throughout the year.
Oh, I like the sound of that.
Yeah, so it's really unusual in the history of clockmaking because the clock has to facilitate this sort of shifting length of time. And it's one of these things that was made possible because Japan closed itself off to the outside world in a policy known as Sokoku. And it reopened in 1878. It looked at all of the inventions of timekeeping right across the world and just went, oh God, we can't possibly, you know, start from scratch again. So they just embraced Western time at that point, which is an awful pity, really.
That's absolutely fantastic. And what else do we have up here?
Well, I suppose different countries are known for different things. For instance, France are known for making the most beautiful clocks. England are known for making the most accurate clocks. But one that's particularly interesting for us here, particularly in terms of developments that are happening in the background, is Germany. Because Germany are known for making the most affordable clocks and one of the most iconic clocks in history, the cuckoo clock.
The cuckoo clock. Tell me about the cuckoo clock.
Well, the cuckoo clock is one of these protected trades. So you could buy a cuckoo clock in Switzerland, but it's not technically a cuckoo clock. It's just a clock with a cuckoo in it. A cuckoo clock, a true cuckoo clock, has to come from the Black Forest region of Germany. It's a little bit like the Waterford Blah. You can make it in Kilkenny, but it's not a Blah unless it's made here.
So it's like Champagne has to be from the Champagne region. And tell me about the cuckoo clock. Anything exciting about to happen right now?
Well, we're particularly excited because we have actually acquired an incredible collection, one of the largest collections of cuckoo clocks in the entire world. And in spring of 2026, so this year, we are going to be opening up a full extension to the Museum of Time where visitors can see these incredible pieces on display.
Unbelievable. I just want to say a huge Happy New Year to all of you and all of your clocks and watches and timepieces. This is so impressive. The listeners will be blown away. And I would advise anyone to come and visit.
Oh, take the time.
And always see what you did there. And I feel like I'm in a time machine. And it is the 40th anniversary. Well, it's just gone of Back to the Future. When you open from New Year's Day onwards?
We open 7 days a week here, from 10 to 5 every single day.
Oh, well, there we go. Did you press a button or did that just come on?
Oh, you know, we have our tricks here.
And that was Cliona Purcell there, the curator of the Irish Museum of Time. And I have to say, you know, over the last year, I visited so many different museums and places and art galleries and what have you. This one was truly special. It really was amazing. If you're near Waterford, even if you're not near Waterford, get in the car, drive down, check out this museum. It will blow your mind. I absolutely loved it.
Henry's Happy New Year. This is News Talk.
You're very welcome back to Henry's Happy New Year. Happy New Year. And I just introduce someone who has just introduced himself. He needs no introduction. It's the showbiz editor of the Irish Sun. He looks refreshed. He doesn't look hungover. He wasn't out last night for New Year's. He's in the studio. It's Ken Sweeney. Ken, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We're here talking about the best gigs of 2025 and what to look forward to in 2026. And we both have similar tastes in music. Actually, scrap that. We don't. Yeah. I like the Pet Shop Boys. You like classy acts, don't you?
I like the Blue Nile, REM, the Go-Betweens. I like those kind of bands. That makes me sound like a bit dated, really. I suppose I am.
And you're a musician at heart.
Yeah, I have been a musician. I only got into journalism when I was 35. I was in indie bands. But listen, we're talking about gigs of 2025 at the moment. I would say to you, the Oasis shows, they were the biggest shows of the year.
Ken, they were huge.
They were massive.
They were absolutely massive. And
massive for drink sales as well.
They were massive for many, many reasons. And I'll give you a few stories about those gigs. So I was covering them for work. So I knew I'd be standing outside with the fans.
Yeah.
And then there was a raffle. There was a raffle here in News Talk to win two tickets, a pair of tickets to the Saturday night, to Oasis. And somehow I beat 320 people, so the whole of the Bauer Media Group.
And as the showbiz editor of the Irish Sun, I will be investigating that.
No, yeah. So we'll start with Oasis. And just hanging out in Ballybock, meeting the fans, meeting the locals. The atmosphere before the gig was something else. Yeah. And then when the gig started, I admit I had trouble getting into the gig because I left it to the very last minute and I shouldn't have. And it was just spectacular as Oasis took to the stage and all the tabloid imagery came up and the flashing lights. Yeah. And it was explosive. And, you know, your memories of Oasis.
My memories are Oasis are this, that, you know, it started with an Oasis shop. Can you imagine this?
Pop-up shop
mm-hmm. just off Stephen's Green. So I was stationed. Yep. We couldn't get into it, but we were outside it. And what I could not believe was how many people had flown into Ireland to see Oasis. A lot of people from Sweden. So many people from America. I thought it would be like English people. No. Americans, Swedes, people who maybe Oasis weren't playing in their country. And they were all going in and they were buying masses of Oasis merchandise. A set list that Oasis were playing because so much of their music, their whole show. And I remember the screens behind Oasis were just insanely
big. Oh, the technology
big.
Was brilliant.
So everything was kind of tied up. The set list ran the exact same way it had run in other places. I mean, it was the exact same order of songs that they did in Dublin. But it was pretty fantastic. Now, it's interesting we talk about Oasis because they were up on stage and Liam Gallagher, as the front man, didn't really engage with the audience. It was almost like he was... they were very happy with him, but it was almost like he was kind of talking to them.
But he doesn't really engage in most gigs. Yeah. He was always a little bit detached. Mm. I would say, I remember seeing them years ago in 1996 in the Old Point, and back then they didn't really engage. I felt there was a real warmth between the crowd and Oasis, and there was a kind of a chemistry. Yeah. There was a beauty. And to say very quickly, Ken, I knew they were going to get back together. And I'll tell you why.
Oh.
I'll tell you how I knew.
How?
So I ended up getting my driveway done by a company called Des Gallagher a paving. And he told me that he was the first cousin to...
oh, my God.
To Oasis.
Yeah.
To Noel and Liam.
Yeah.
And he told me when he was doing my drive. Yeah. And I said, really? He said, they're definitely going to get back together. Watch this space. They're going to get back together. Wow. And they did. And they did this global world tour.
It was an incredible show for them. Mm.
Come on, hold my hand. I wanna contact the living. Not sure I understand this road I've been given. I sit and talk to God, and He just laughs at my plans. My head speaks a language I don't understand. I just wanna feel real love, feel the home that I live in. 'Cause I got too much life running through my veins, going through waste.
We're going to talk about another big gig here, Robbie Williams, because Robbie Williams was the exact opposite from Oasis, because he actually got down off the stage and he engaged with the crowd and entertained them. And it was...
I loved that gig, didn't you?
I mean, actually, the film, the Robbie Williams film, where there's a chimp playing him, is an amazing film.
People
Please
say it's 5-star.
Watch it. It's just, you get over the monkey pretty quick, but it's very good. But there's so much in it. He engaged with the fans, you know, and I felt for entertainment wise, you know, the variety of what was happening on stage. And as an entertainer, I thought Robbie Williams was much better than Oasis.
Did you prefer
it?
Did you prefer that gig? You preferred it. And you're a musician.
I know.
Ken, I do love Robbie Williams. And he came over to promote the gig, and we got to meet him. And because that gig was just a week after Oasis, I didn't go to Robbie Williams. And I'll tell you why.
You missed.
I hadn't recovered from Oasis.
I did not.
It took it out of me. I was in bits. It was only like 6-7 days later. I couldn't recover in time.
We're talking about big gigs, but remember, there's so many great bands playing places like the Workman's Club and Whelan's and places like that as well. You know, there's this thing about, you know, little gigs, indie bands playing those kind of venues, and people are having very special moments at that. But also, I mean, I wasn't at it, but, you know, strangely enough, even though I'm into indie Irish music, I'm not that big a fan of My Bloody Valentine, but people were very interested in that gig. A lot of people went to that. They got their rear plugs and they went to My Bloody Valentine. They played recently at the Three Arena. Are bands playing too much, Henry? That's the thing. When I was a kid, if you missed a band, they mightn't come back ever, or they might come back 3 years later. Mm-hmm. But now it seems that bands will come back. I mean, how many times have the Killers played? How many times have Chic played in Ireland?
Well, that's a really, really good point. And I think the reason why they keep playing and they keep touring is because of streaming. It's because of Spotify. Yeah. They might make 1p, 2p or 5 cents or whatever per stream, where they can actually make money by touring. Also, to change the subject completely, a gig that did quite well, it was only small, it was 1,000 people, and it was in Navan, and it was Nick Kershaw. Wouldn't it be good? And it was. And, you know, that's another really, really good gig. Also for me, St. Anne's Park, during the summer, there was something called the Rewind.
Yeah.
And Billy Ocean was headlining it. Yeah. And Billy Ocean was brilliant.
You see,
Billy Ocean
about
was
people,
amazing.
People from the 80s and 90s who have money. Listen, I got to say this as well. Zach Bryan, Phoenix Park, they were the biggest gigs of the year. Massive gigs of the year.
Country.
Three nights, country, and people of all ages at those gigs. A lot of people coming down from the north. There's a country act playing Slane next year. Country is in the ascent, right?
Yes.
So it's the mad thing. Country doesn't really get played on the radio down here in the south, but it's huge up north.
Oh, it's huge. I had a relative flying in for the UK for those Phoenix Park gigs. There was 3 or 4 of them.
Yeah.
I mean, people are loving, I suppose, country pop or young country.
Yeah, and I think
massive.
Yeah, it is. And also there was alcohol-free areas, those Phoenix Park gigs. So that was really interesting. That's the first time that's kind of been done. So, you know, people aren't falling around you on the way to the bar, getting up every 5 minutes to get a drink in or something like that, you know.
And we've got John Bon Jovi coming.
Yeah. He's coming in as well. So it's like
In 26.
Yeah, so I think, you know, there you have it. You know, like people like to know what they're getting, and they, you know, they want to relive, you know, their lives with these songs.
And I just want to say to you, Ken Sweeney, I just want to say thank you so much for coming in on New Year's Day.
Yeah.
And I just have to quote a Billy Ocean song here. Yeah. I want you to get out of my dreams and I want you to get into my car.
Can I just add one moment? You mentioned my life as a musician. My album, Understand, got re-released by a label called Needle Mythology, which is an English label. They re-released the Whipping Boy album a few years ago, but they re-released my album on Satanta Records from 1992. Understood, they called it, yeah. So breakup album, lots of jangly guitar music. And that was, I think my highlight of the year was that was single. That was album of the week in Terror Records on vinyl. So it's lovely for people.
It was album of the week.
It was album of the week.
You kept that quiet.
Yeah. And it got reviewed in Mojo and it got reviewed in Classic Pop and it was just lovely again because it was just great going back.
Ken Sweeney, Happy New Year. Thank you so much for joining us here on New Year's Day for Henry's Happy New Year.
Thank you, Henry.
And that's all for Henry's Happy New Year. A huge thanks to my production team who did a sterling job, Anne-Marie Kane, Aidan McKelvey and Heather Blackburn. Take it away and a Happy New Year. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Henry's Happy New Year. This is News Talk.
Hello, it's News Talk's Jess Kelly here. Before we get to this podcast, I want to talk to the business owners out there who know the value of having the right partner behind them. When it comes to empowering your business, Electric Ireland is the trusted energy brand that Irish companies rely on. As Ireland's leading energy supplier, they offer fixed price plans, expert advice and future-focused solutions, including solar power installation to support your business on its journey to net zero. Electric Ireland, making your business brighter. Visit electricireland.ie/business to learn more. Now, enjoy your podcast.